Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Robert Avely. Bob is professor of humanities and philosophy at Diablo Valley College in California in the Berkeley area, the Bay Area. He's authored four books. One is Democracy Now. Another is Anatomy of a Deception. It's about the Iraq invasion. Well, the deception of the evasions. The Iraq invasion, the occupation, and the preparation for the next deception. And it never really takes that long for the next one to come along. Well, we got Libya last year. We've had lots of small ones in the interim. We're building up to the Syrian deception, then the Iranian deception, and then the unknown ones after that, or as they say, the ones to be named later to come up after it. That's the way America does business. It doesn't matter whether it's under Obama or George Bush or the man in the moon. America has a permanent war policy. It literally is going after one country after another. The war profiteers demand it. The politicians deliver it. Millions of people suffer and die. It's the American way. Bob, welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
So much going on. I'm scared to death about what's happening, and I literally can smell and taste another war.
Oh, we're already underway with the wars. You know, what I try to do in a minutes before I get in touch with you and we have our talks, I just sit down and I write out a list of areas that we might want to discuss while we're talking. And, of course, U.S. wars have to be among those. And as I started writing out my list this morning, I listed out all of the wars that the United States is engaged in, threatening, developing, getting ready to move into. Here's my list. Are you ready for this?
Oh,
this
my goodness.
It's going to take half an hour.
It's going to take from now to the end of the program.
Egypt, Bahrain, cyber wars, Pakistan, Mexico, U.S. border, Yemen, Afghanistan, China, Iran, Syria, the war on academia going on in the United States. You've written about that, the student loan thing. The war with the drones. That's just where I started with listing the wars and thinking, well, we should talk about some of these, but my gosh, if we talked about all of these, we'd have to go 2 hours. But these are the wars that it would be good to pin Obama with, and I think rightfully we could do that. But it's really what you had said. It's really the system, the complex of American politics combined with American corporations, especially the defense contractors, that push these wars on everyone so that the capitalists can control the world. And combining that with the war machine makes it a very potent and also a very destructive force, not just for everybody that we're warring against, but for ourselves as well. And we see that with austerity.
Boy, do we ever. Ordinary people suffer so the corporate profiteers can make lots of money, get lots richer, and the war profiteers extend way beyond the weapons makers. Literally everybody gets involved, not everybody, but so many of the corporate interests get involved in America's wars. It takes a lot more than weapons and munitions to wage them. One of the lines is, armies that travel on their stomachs and so on. Well, they also travel on their backsides and the rest of it. And lots of money is made. And these corporations demand wars. I mean, they want them. It's a sad situation. And America literally is waging war on humanity, and it's been going on for a very, very long time. And not enough people in the country understand this. People outside the country, Bob, understand this much better than most Americans. Certainly anybody who listens to this program and others like it understand it very, very well. But the Fox News addicts or the CNN addicts or whatever, they know absolutely nothing. One more quick comment, then you jump back, Bob. Just recently, I've seen this before, but I saw it again just recently, that the survey done of people who watch Fox News, it could have been CNN, it could have been any of them, but they picked on Fox News. The more they watch Fox News, the less they know, and the people, I guess they queried people who watch the channel versus querying a group of people who don't watch it and asking them specific questions about world national events. The people who did not watch Fox knew more about what really is going on than the people who do watch Fox. But they really should do is the people who depend on television news in America versus people who refuse to watch that stuff. And there's no question that the latter group is much, much better informed than the former group. The former group knows nothing.
That's not only true, but, you know, there's another dynamic to that. When I do turn on Fox occasionally, not very often because it makes me throw my shoes at the TV, but when I do turn on Fox, one of the things that I really see there that seems very prominent to me that I don't hear anybody else talking about is what they're advocating across the line is what we would call under normal circumstances fascism. They're trying to rejuvenate this national identity by aligning Americans up against every other nation and people, especially dark-skinned people, that are supposedly causing the degeneration of our nation and promoting political violence and warfare and an authoritarian state, even though they say they don't, but an authoritarian state to stop these alleged people who are bringing America down. And those are pretty standard themes you see on Fox, and I think that's what you call fascism. And that goes right into the ideology that has been taught at U.S. military academies that right after we had our last discussion, the news came out about that military officer, the Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Dooley, I think his name was, who was teaching in the military academy in Norfolk, Virginia, who was teaching his students that we are engaged in a total war against the world's 1.4 billion Muslims, and it was necessary to protect America from Muslim terrorists. So he was teaching them about taking war to the civilian population, advocating the destruction of any type of Islam. That's going on at our military academies, and so this is not just a little drop in the bucket. This is what the ideology of fascism looks like, and when it's in the military academies, when it's on the networks, and when it gets into the Republican Party, you've got a real serious problem on your hands, because then all the money gets shifted over into the military complex, because it's the idea of a corporate defense profitability meets up with an ideology that says you've got enemies all over the world in this particular group. Let's go attack them.
Well, I think fascism sums it up very well, Bob. We really have a situation that in too many disturbing ways replicates fascism. It's very ugly. It's very disturbing. And my goodness, the longer this goes on, the worse it gets. I really see a very bad ending on this. It's shocking. You know, just the list that you read off at the top of the program, it really is shocking. And there's so much stuff going on we don't even know about. The Washington Post, of all places, it was over a year ago now, wrote a detailed article when Petraeus was the U.S. commander, either Afghanistan or Iraq. Well, he was the Afghan commander before he came in to be CIA director. And I don't know why he would want to leak this kind of information, maybe to scare the world. But the article was about U.S. Special Forces, another word for them, are deployed death squads. They are deployed in around 120 countries worldwide, and they don't go there for anything other than mischief. They're death squads. They're going in to create mischief, maybe assassinate people, and they're trained to be expert killers. And these are the people that are leading the Syrian insurgency right now. U.S. Special Forces, British Special Forces, French forces were there before. I imagine they still are. Qatari Special Forces, CIA, MI6, British Intelligence. They have been in Syria for months. They did the exact same thing in Libya. They led the insurgents, these killers. They trained them. They funded them. They armed them. They led them. They picked targets. And when you see a massacre like Hula Bob, or the latest one a couple of days ago in Kube, a village of Kube, a tiny village in Hama province, around 78 people murdered in cold blood, and these people were pro-Assad loyalists. I wrote about it. I wrote about what's going on at the military school as well, Bob. I had that thought on my mind and I lost it and it just popped back in again. I think their officers, captains or maybe majors on up, ordinary people don't go to those schools. They teach the higher ranking officers the fact that Islam is evil and America has to be at war with Islam to protect national security. What a bunch of garbage.
And let's add to that, I mean, we can go to Syria or Yemen or wherever you would like to go with this, but U.S. Special Operations Command, otherwise referred to by its acronym as USOCOM, is under Obama, their budget has quadrupled over what it was with Bush. And this is, goes right to what you were talking about. Obama trumpets in public his winding down of the Iraq wars and the Afghan wars, and everybody cheers on the Democratic side. But what is not talked about is his expanding secret wars that he's doing, and that includes Yemen, and he does that through the U.S. Special Operations Command. So he's quadrupled their budget and added more than twice the number of people to that command that George Bush had. So now there's roughly something like 60,000 or 65,000 people there. And you're right, you hit the right number. He has put them in 120 countries this year, running up to that total, in which they're supposed to engage in reconnaissance and counterterrorism and what Obama calls humanitarian assistance and occasionally direct action. And so Andrew Bacevich writes about this, and he says, well, if you're going to do that, then you've immediately dismissed accountability and you've instituted an imperial presidency, because what Obama does in secret, no one is allowed to know unless Obama chooses to let you know it through his campaign coordination, and then you don't have any accountability for the president or anybody else. But it's done in Syria and in Yemen and other places that you speak of through the U.S. Special Operations Command. Their whole idea is to foment rebellion, tensions, civil war even in the case of Syria, which allows a pretext then for a more formal war to be engaged.
Oh, exactly, exactly. And again, if anybody watches the scoundrel media, the scoundrel television in America, they will know absolutely nothing about all this stuff going on. But there certainly is a war short of NATO intervention going on in Syria. There's another kind of war that's been longstanding against Iran. Some of the things that you mentioned, Bob, internal subversion, assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, virus-laden malware, the Stuxnet corrupted Iranian operations a year or two ago, and I think that one got straightened out. But there's a new one that's called Flame malware, and I just wrote about it in an article I put out this morning. And experts say it's 20 times the potency of the Stuxnet. And I gave some examples of how others, I know nothing about this. I'm certainly not an expert on getting computer viruses, getting anything infected with a computer virus. But I quoted some wonderful people who are very knowledgeable on this. And there was a little bit of not contradiction, but differences of agreement, where on the one hand, some described this as the way that it gets infected. And very possibly what was described could be a way where it's brought in from the outside, that people, I forget the terminology, it was a bit on the technical side, but people working in Iranian nuclear facilities bring things from their home computer to their jobs, this gets installed on computers, or maybe things related to their work, and this gets installed into the system that's running Iran's nuclear program, and the virus is in there, and the people doing this don't realize that, and this is the way that the infection can hit the Iranian system. And then others made the comment that no one is really sure how the virus infects, but it has. There have been dozens of attacks on Iran's nuclear facility. It mentioned a number of countries, and the number of attacks to one degree or another successful, I guess, not a lot of clarity on the comment I saw, but I saw the number 189 attacks against Iran, and when they said that, I assume it meant that there have been, to one degree or another, attacks that have caused some damage, certainly at different operations of Iran's system. If you want to infect something, you wouldn't infect one thing 189 times. And it mentioned that Israel-Palestine, they combined the two together. These are the experts talking. Israel-Palestine has been infected 98 times. Didn't mention America. I mean, America has to be targeted by this unless the opposition forces have no idea what this flame malware is, and they aren't able to use it. But if they can't use this, they can certainly use something else. So this is a very destructive war, Bob. You destroy an operation, whether it's a nuclear operation, whether it's an industrial plant, whatever it is, you destroy it by infecting it with a virus that is so sophisticated, it's very, very hard to undo the damage. Well, that may be as effective as bombing. So why bomb if you can do it this way?
Yeah, you're right. That's where Obama is turning a lot of his energy to the cyber warfare. And you labeled Iran at the top of the list. And in my reading, that's exactly right, because Iran has been targeted more than anybody else. And there, you don't hear anything about the United States, but it's probably going to rebound on us. But I'll talk more about that in a second. But the Stuxnet virus that you talk about was a U.S.-Israel combination virus that was sent originally to Iran's nuclear enrichment plant at Natanz, and it caused their high-speed centrifuges to spin out of control until they crashed, literally crashed. And so that was the first attack that occurred. And then you mentioned the flame virus, which is the new one. That's 20 times more powerful than Stuxnet. But what the flame virus does is it transforms every computer that it enters into a spy, because it sends back to its originator all of the data on that computer whenever it's used. Video, audio, keyboard strokes, even keyboard strokes, goes back to the originator. So the flame virus is an actual virus that it's like having a CIA agent in the middle of the country, because they get all the information that's used on those computers. That's the 189 computers that you mentioned that have been infected by the flame virus that they're spying for the United States and Israel. The other virus that you mentioned was the wiper virus. It's called the wiper virus. And that, what that does is it breaks down communications between various functions of industry. So, for example, in Iran's oil industry, when the United States or Israel attacks with the wiper virus, that breaks down the communication that occurs between points along that oil industry, so that they can't develop a communication link back and forth, so they can't tell what each other's doing. And I just read the other day about a new virus that's called Duku, I think. It's D-U-Q-U, I think that's how you spell it. And that's a malware system that targets systems, and it was attached to Stuxnet. And what it does is it breaks down all possibilities for that computer to work properly as well. So there's all these viruses that Obama's ordered to be sent out in attacking other countries. Iran, the West Bank, you mentioned the other computers in the West Bank, Sudan is in there, Syria, Lebanon's in there. They're all enemies of the United States and Israel, and that's where all these viruses are turning up. So even though nobody is deliberately and overtly claiming credit for it, New York Times said this is U.S.-Israeli started. On June 1st, they had this article, that's what I'm quoting from, that all of these viruses are coming from either the U.S. or Israel. And when you add to that, that the Pentagon has now an agency that's called the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Its acronym is DARPA. Their whole task, their whole mandate is to, they've got a $110 million research program, and what they're attempting to do is map all of the entirety of cyberspace in real time, so that they will know through this map who's doing what on any computer in the world. And it automatically updates itself, And it allows the commanders to look at who's doing what, and with that knowledge, they can attack through viruses and disable the computers that are doing what they don't want them to. So they can launch these attacks while at the same time having a defense wall that they can't be attacked back. And they're trying to do this even with an automatic program, so that if certain things come up from certain computers that the Defense Department doesn't like being done, it's an automatic attack on that computer. Now, the problem is that there's unintended consequences that come from this that nobody's talking about. Like, if you attack the wrong computer and you shut down a hospital system or an electrical grid for civilians, or you end up damaging systems that aren't targeted at all, there's no fail-safe in there. But the United States doesn't care about that. We just care about having the best bomb, and in this case, it's a cyber bomb.
That's exactly right. And my understanding is the flame malware is a U.S.-Israeli partnership of producing this. And I think in anything involving Iran and involving Syria, I would guess anything in the Middle East, Bob, it's a U.S.-Israeli partnership going after targets that they both want eliminated, and it's always for the same reason. It's not about the type of government that a country has per se. It's a case of whether the government is independent or whether it's subservient to Western interests. In the case of Israel, Israel wants to be a regional hegemon. America wants to be a global dominant power. Israel is a little less ambitious than that, but it wants to have global influence, absolutely. And Israel operates globally, cooperatively with Washington on some of the nefarious schemes. But Israel wants to eliminate rivals in the region. So America fought its war with Iraq for it. And then Libya. Well, Gaddafi wasn't really a rival. I'm certain Israel wanted Gaddafi removed. Syria is a rival. Iran is a rival. Turkey is a rival. For a good many months, there's been a lot of friction between Israel and Turkey. And I just wrote about Turkey doing something. I hope they follow through in it. I wrote two articles on it, that the Turkish government indicted four former top Israeli military commanders responsible for the May 2010 Mavi Marmara massacre, the humanitarian mission to Gaza. They were boarded by Israeli commandos, the same special forces types, killers, death squads. They boarded this ship. Nobody on the ship was armed. They were all nonviolent. They were bringing humanitarian aid. Israeli forces, and I must have written a dozen articles on this in the aftermath, maybe more than that, several while the event was going on, or right after it was concluded, then a good many after it, because there were a lot of things that happened after this event passed. Investigations, multiple investigations, two by the UN. Israel did its own. Two were whitewashes. One was legitimate. There's no question that it was cold-blooded murder. But the Israeli forces came on this ship with photos to be able to identify people marked for death. And those were the people killed. They all happened to be Turkish nationals, nine of them. Nine Turkish nationals. Well, Turkey, at least rhetorically, has not taken this sitting down, Bob. Turkey was willing to let it go on two conditions, that it get the kind of apology that it wants. Israel has stonewalled, refuses to do it. Israel never says it's sorry, and Turkey wanted just compensation for families of the surviving family members. I don't know how you ever get compensation for your loved ones being murdered, but and Israel, I think, was agreeable to that. Maybe not what these people deserve, but they were agreeable to compensation. They would not issue a formal apology, so they've been at loggerheads. And just in recent days, four former Israeli commanders were indicted. Arrest warrants were issued for them if they entered Turkish territory. Not Interpol. not Interpol, which is what Turkey should have done to have a warrant out. I guess that's a universal warrant of some sort. So literally, if these Israelis go out of the country, any sovereign country can arrest them. Well, there are people in Israel who check with their foreign ministry before they travel to certain countries. The same is true in America. I did a follow-up article on the indictment and trial. In this November 6th, I believe the day was, for 3 days will be the initial hearing in court on this trial, and they want to invite to give testimony hundreds of people, everybody on the ship. There were a good many, I don't recall the number on the ship, but a good many on the ship, and family members, and they were quoting numbers like over 400 people will be given a chance, if they wish to come to court and to testify based on their first-hand knowledge what went on. Well, if just a good number of them decide they'll do it, you can't hold a three-day trial. This thing could go on for weeks, maybe longer than that. And the Israelis will be tried in absentia because they won't show up. But I hope they go ahead with this trial. They're getting very, very heavy pressure from Washington not to do it. They announced it. It was reported in the Turkish media. I quoted them on this. It's a long time between now and November. Anything can happen. I would like to see them convicted no matter what happens to them. Nobody's going to lay a glove on them. But to get a conviction in a court in a sovereign country would be a big step forward. Now let's do it to the U.S. war criminals.
Good luck on that one. But the Turkey's playing an interesting game here, given everything that you have said, and I remember reading stories about the issues that you're talking about. The other side of that is that in the face of all of this heavy U.S. pressure on Turkey to not do what you're talking about, the other side is the U.S. is pressuring Turkey to get involved in their clandestine warfare in Syria. So Turkey is supplying light arms to the battalion commanders of the opposition in Syria. It's training the Syrian opposition in Istanbul. It's stocking materials up for the opposition in Damascus and in Idlib near the Turkish border. So Turkey's doing two different things. One against American wishes, one in favor of American wishes. This is trying to walk a very fine line there. So hopefully they're successful on the one and not the other. Excuse me, not the other.
Oh, any success would be wonderful. There have been some attempts. I've written about how there've been a lot of almost, Bob. That's the best way to describe it. A lot of almost. There is something called universal jurisdiction. Any country, if an individual enters their territory and they're guilty of crimes against humanity, war crimes, serious crimes that rise to the level of those two things, to the level of genocide, the kind of things that are too grievous to be ignored. If anybody charged with these offenses show up in their territory under the law of universal jurisdiction, they can arrest them, they can detain them, they can put them on trial, and they can convict them and they can put them in prison. Well, there was a big almost in the UK. Can't imagine Britain ever doing anything like this, but it almost happened. Well, I don't think it really almost happened. It looked good while it was going on. Augusto Pinochet, Chile. It's been a few years now, maybe further back than that. But Pinochet, I believe, is dead now. He never had an answer for his crimes, but he was detained in Britain, put under house arrest for many, many months, and then finally. Must have been intense pressure that got him released, and one of the things cited was his ill health. Well, I wouldn't have cared if he was on his deathbed. They still should have put him on trial, wheeled him into the courtroom like Mubarak was done in Egypt. And I didn't even care about that one. The people trying him were the ones I really wanted to see put on trial. But Pinochet was held house arrest in Britain. They wouldn't let him go home, and they held him for many months. And, you know, in a just world, who knows what might have happened. I'm certain he had some uneasy days while this was going on. They do go after former heads of state, but they go after the wrong ones. So I forget his name. Somebody was just convicted in recent weeks, and I think he got 50 years in prison, a former head of state for one of the small, Liberia, former head of Liberia. God, I know his name so well, and it's just not on the tip of my tongue. But he was just convicted. I believe he got a 50-year sentence for the crimes he committed. But the crimes he committed are nothing, Bob, compared to the crimes committed against Liberia and against the other countries in the region and the other countries around the world, dare I say. And the only people who show up in the International Criminal Court that's supposed to be trying the real criminals are the ones the real criminals want to have tried for the crimes, for the offenses that are committed against them. Maybe that's the best way to put it. So they want to bring a Gaddafi's son to the International Criminal Court to be put on trial for the crimes that NATO committed against Syria. That's the way the deal works.
And they arrested his lawyer this morning, too, for allegedly passing threatening papers to Gaddafi's son. That was on Al Jazeera this morning. They don't hesitate to arrest Julian Assange and put him up on incredible charges that don't have any legal substance to them, and that's what we're seeing right now. But they're not going to prosecute the people who need to be prosecuted, war criminals, George Bush, you know, Donald Rumsfeld, even Barack Obama, who has committed a multitude of war crimes, including the big one for me, for Obama, is the war crime of attacking people with drones and claiming to have the power to assassinate whomever he wants without any type of oversight. That's war crimes. I mean,
that's a war crime. That's an absolute war crime. And Obama's got a kill list. I wrote about that recently. A kill list. And the New York Times wrote about this in depth. And they made a couple of astonishing comments, like, quote unquote, they quoted somebody close to Obama saying, quote unquote, killing comes easy to him.
Oh, right.
Killing comes easy to. Can you imagine that? I mean, a guy who campaigned as a peace president, et cetera, and so on. We need to take a break, Bob. It just goes on and on, and he doesn't give a damn about humanity. He ravages it. The guy's name, who I couldn't think of, was Charles Taylor, and earlier, a few years earlier, his son, Chucky Taylor, was convicted in one of these kangaroo courts, and I forget how many years he got. He got a long sentence, too. Anyway, we'll be right back. Welcome back, talking to Bob Abele. So many topics. Bob, I love it when we get on together because we can just get into any number of issues. There are so many domestic issues, foreign issues. Often there's a connection between the two. As we get closer to November, we can talk about electoral issues. To me, it doesn't really matter who's elected.
It doesn't.
On issues mattering most, I say this so often, Bob, on issues mattering most, there's not a dime's worth of difference separating Obama from Romney. I love, what was the name somebody gave them? Romney, I think there's one with, the other one doesn't sound right. Oh, Romney sounds like the name that somebody must have given them. You know, they differ on some other issues that are important, especially to the people affected, but they don't rise to the level of war and peace or corporate empowerment and the other major things that cause so much harm, so much destruction to so many people on a global basis. These are the big things, and that's where these two candidates are absolutely in lockstep, and it doesn't matter. It could be them. It could be somebody unknown we never heard of, and it literally doesn't matter who sits in the Oval Office. They all pretty much are the same. It's gotten worse over the years, and this is the trend that we're on. As bad as things were, my goodness, Jimmy Carter was no saint. Anybody who thinks Harry Truman was a saint has another thought coming. Anybody who thinks Franklin Roosevelt was a saint has another thought coming. At the same time, compared to the rogues we have today, I'll sure take them over what we have now, including Republican Dwight Eisenhower, who I remember so well, long before he ever became president, and how well I remember his campaign in 1952. Oh, my goodness. Well, I could reminisce, but the current issues are much more important. But when will Obama stop, Bob? When he blows up the whole world and there's nothing left to attack? Is that what it'll take to stop these guys?
I think you're probably onto something there. I've actually been thinking that for the last week or so, that where is the end for this? And I'm thinking that in the context of the general American philosophy of pragmatism, and that is, if it works, do it. And so you don't have a principled set of decisions that are made, or principled people in positions of power. You have the people in positions of power that will get away with whatever they can until they're stopped from doing it. And that goes from Obama all the way down to even the local level. Collect as much power as you can, squeeze out anybody who's threatening to that power, and then keep going until you're stopped. I don't really see any end in sight here if nobody's going to stand up and stop Obama from doing this. So I'm looking to see what Occupy Wall Street is doing, and I just learned last night that their next move is to engage in a guitar army of people walking from Philadelphia to New York or something in a couple of weeks and singing folk songs. That's not going to stop Obama. Not when Obama says everybody that's of military age in a drone zone, I can strike as a combatant unless there is posthumous intelligence that proves them innocent, then I can go ahead and do that. When you're claiming that kind of power, that is in complete opposition to international law, there's not even a shadow of a doubt about that, and you don't care about it, who's going to stop you? It's going to have to be your own people. But you're right. If you're upset with what Obama has done militarily or even domestically, and you look at Romney, I don't see a whole lot of daylight between them, particularly in their economic positions. Romney might be a little bit more radical. Obama moves a little slower. But their policies are essentially the same. So what are you going to do? There's no pragmatic end to that. So my solution is that we had better find our conscience and understand the principles that are involved here, the wrongness of what's going on, the inequality of our economic system, which I think people are waking up to, and I think people know that. But the next step then is get off the couch and go do something about it. And that's what I don't see people doing. And that's going to be the only stop to Obama's push, unless he continues, and like you said, destroys everything. Unless the countries of the world come together and fight back against the United States. Then you've got a World War III scenario, which Obama's setting up anyway by all the wars that we talked about at the top of the hour. So we're really in kind of a quagmire now. All of this ongoing systemic corruption, a lot of it brought about by capitalism influencing democracy and kind of destroying democracy. Democracy is coming to an end unless we stop this very soon. And it's going to have to be a unified people. That was tried in Wisconsin, and there was no power there, and it ultimately fell to money. So where you go from this, it's got to be a lot of lessons that people have to start thinking about if they really want their government to work for them rather than for the 1%.
Well, that's exactly right, Matt. And again, it just gets worse and worse. And I mentioned a few presidents, but go back to Jimmy Carter. Reagan was worse than Carter. Bush Sr. was really part of the Reagan 12 years. So we had 12 years of that combination. Or Bush 1 solo for 4 years, continuation of just about the same policies. And Bush 1 was the one who, in his own words, we finally licked the Vietnam syndrome, where Reagan concentrated more on proxy wars, Central America, Africa, I think some other places, Grenada down in the near South America, this tiny little island that he sent the Marines in, my goodness, on a fake rescue mission. How well I remember that. That was the opening volley, and then the Contra Wars and so much more. But Bush 1 was the one brave Bush 1, he took out Manuel Noriega, 1989. Chicago Police Force could have done it just as well. That wasn't a war. That was a walkover. but then the Gulf War, 1990, the sanctions, and Saddam was suckered into doing what he did. He literally wouldn't have done it without U.S. permission, and that's exactly what happened. April Glaspie, the U.S. ambassador to Baghdad, Saddam literally checked with her after the Kuwaitis were stealing Iraqi oil. They were cross-drilling into Iraqi territory, stealing Iraqi oil. Saddam tried for months to negotiate a stoppage, a settlement to this, and the Kuwaitis were egged on by Washington because Washington wanted an excuse to go to war, so they had to sucker Saddam into doing something stupid, and for a smart guy, he fell for it. Even the smart ones can make stupid mistakes, and he did, and he believed the U.S. ambassador. Believed the U.S. ambassador. He should have known better. Nobody believes a UN, a U.S. ambassador. Nobody should believe any Western ambassador, and too many of the others as well. And she suckered him into giving him a green light to invade Kuwait. And the horror story, the nightmare that's unfolded after that, it wasn't just the Gulf War, but the 1990s, Bill Clinton's wars, the bombings that were rarely ever reported, the sanctions that, in the words of Dennis Halliday, who was one of the UN humanitarian oil for food chief representatives in Iraq. Genocide was going on. This was his words. He quit his job. Hans von Spanner quit for the same reason. And Halliday, I remember quoting Halliday saying, he refused any longer to be part of a genocide that kills 5,000 Iraqi children every month. Every month. That's what the Clinton sanctions did on Iraq. Saddam wasn't harmed. The Iraqi officials weren't harmed. And this went on and on right up to the eve of the 2003 war. Shock and awe. And the fighting is still going on now. There was no withdrawal from Iraq. That was fake. U.S. troops were repositioned. There's still 50,000 or so there. But they repositioned them to nearby areas, Kuwait, other parts of the region. And I quoted Obama. Last fall, I believe it was, he gave a speech about how America would concentrate its efforts in the future on two regions of the world, Bob. One was the Middle East, that's pretty obvious, and the other was the Asia Pacific, and that's what's going on. And Panetta is winding up, I believe today, he's winding up his East Asia, South Asia tour to enlist support from other Asian countries to give America basing rights. And I quoted him when he was stopping off in Vietnam. He was in Cam Ranh Bay. How well I remember Cam Ranh Bay, this major deep water port that America used. And after being involved in a 30-year war against the Vietnamese people, and those people are still suffering today from that war, 37 years after it ended in the mid-1970s, apparently the Vietnamese, Bob, are willing to give America basing rights again at Cam Ranh Bay, and who knows what else. I know there's a history of friction between Vietnam and China, but Vietnam is lining up on the wrong side. Didn't the 30-year war teach them anything?
Not just Vietnam, but, I mean, you look at everybody that the United States is trying to kind of sidle up to. They're involved in talks with Korea. Obviously, you mentioned the Philippines. Panetta's running around the Southeast Asia region and lining up as many different countries as he can. I was starting to make a list this morning of all the places that the United States has been involved with. Got South Korea, Japan, back to Guam, Australia, Philippines, Vietnam, Sri Lanka, Pakistan. They're after Pakistan. They're trying to get Pakistan on their side. But Burma and Nepal, along with Afghanistan, they're trying to get all of them for military bases so that they can start harassing China as China starts moving through the South China Sea with their exports. Hillary Clinton is even talking about the South China Sea now as the West Philippine Sea, which is deliberately provocative against China. So, yeah, the Vietnamese haven't really learned a lot from all of this, neither of any of these other countries, and they're trying to squeeze the Chinese. And Chinese and Philippines, the Philippines have almost been in a couple of confrontations already in the late May and early June, that they've been vessels have been confronting each other on the South China Sea near the Scarborough Shoal, And the Philippines could never do that. They could never confront Chinese ships and harass them if they weren't backed by the U.S. So you have Leon Panetta over there trying to sidle up to all these various places. You've got Filipino ships from their Navy with American backing starting to harass the Chinese ships. You've got the Australian government that is now scrambling to try to take cover for the secret chapter that was contained in their defense budget that was never released to the public, that talked about Australian forces assisting U.S. military personnel to start putting a naval blockade on China's sea routes. China is Australia's largest trading partner. And this is a really interesting development as this goes. It actually shows the contradictions of capitalism, I think, because one of the things is the world's largest partnership of trade are the world's two largest economies, the United States and China. And now we're sliding toward war with China because they seem to be coming on economically, even though they've slowed down a bit. They're coming on economically, and so what does the United States do? We're going to get a bunch of people together on our side, and we're going to stop you from growing, even if it hurts us. We've got a real problem going on here in China with this whole military provocation that's been going on. So I don't know where it's going, but Panetta, as you say, is running around in Southeast Asia trying to sign all these people on, and they're signing on. So what are you going to do? And Panetta's talking about the development of an advanced fifth-generation fighter that they're going to put out there, a Virginia-class submarine. What are you going to do? You've got more muscle instead of dialogue. And Kevin Rudd, the former prime minister of Australia, was trying to engage in dialogue with the Chinese, and Obama squelched it. So where are you going to go? That's the foreign policy issue. I don't know if I'm the only one that thinks this, Steve, but I keep reading this stuff, and I think I go back to World War II. Hitler invades Austria. Hitler, you know, starts invading these other countries, and one by one they fall over to him, and he sidles up with other countries and then overtakes them. Don't we have something similar going on now? Aren't we the ones doing what it was that Hitler was doing, with Hitler claiming all this centralized power and Obama doing the same thing? Am I missing something in history, no, or are we seeing history again?
Oh, we're seeing history again. We really, on the other hand, it's hard for me to imagine, Bob, that America wants a war with either China or Russia. These are strong countries. America likes to go to war with pushovers. Well, when you cross the line to Syria, and especially Iran, they are not pushovers, but they certainly are not in the same league militarily with China, and especially Russia, that has a nuclear arsenal that can match America's. But China has a formidable nuclear arsenal also, and they have delivery systems able to hit U.S. targets. Whether China could hit the East Coast, I don't know. But China could certainly hit the West Coast. It could knock out, dare I say, Bob, San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, Seattle,
there.
Portland. I mean, they could knock out those cities if they wanted to. My God, I mean, they have all kinds of sophisticated stuff, very talented people in the country, and the country is making advanced strides technologically. They have lots of problems, and they certainly don't have a government if that's the ideal by a long shot. At the same time, China is not belligerent. China isn't looking to have a war with anybody. There may be a little spat here or there along the way, but there's no country that China has been at war with in my memory. You have to go back a good ways. Well, World War II, of course, and they didn't start it, and there've been some scraps after that. They got into America's Korean War, going to the aid of the North Koreans, who did not start that war. The South started it at the behest of Harry Truman, and one of the many dirty stories. But it's hard imagining America would want a war with either of these countries, Bob. At the same time, sometimes things happen that you didn't necessarily want, that you didn't necessarily expect. And I've written, and I mentioned it again recently, that there have been some lunatic people in high places in America. Going back to the Kennedy years, I wrote a couple of times about General Curtis LeMay, who thought this was the time, you know, the early 1960s, This was the time to hit the Soviets when they're down, and they were down. They were still recovering from World War II. They were decimated. Country was decimated. They lost at least 20 million people. It could have been double that amount. Stalin didn't keep count. Millions of Russians lost their lives. The country was just ravaged by destruction. It took a couple of decades to do the rebuilding, and there still may be scars from World War II today. But I mean, as brutish as Stalin was, there's no way he wanted a war with the West. He would have had his head handed to him. His own people in his country, the people around him, probably would have handed him his head. But Russia got targeted. LeMay wanted to nuke Russia when they were down, and they had nuclear weapons, and they had intercontinental missiles, and his line was, well, you know, we can lose a few U.S. cities, but that's a price worth paying. And there was another general at the time, Lemenser, who had the same kind of lunatic ideas, and Kennedy, we had Kennedy then, we don't have Obama or George Bush. Kennedy was so furious about this, he wanted none of it. I quoted from a meeting that he was in with General Lemenster when he came up with some of these ideas, and Kennedy was so enraged, he got up in the middle of the meeting and stormed out of the room. Can you imagine Obama doing something like that? One other comment, Bob, then you jump back in. We're getting near the end of the program. But here, America is positioning its forces, surrounding Russia with military bases, a so-called missile shield that's for offense, not defense, wants to establish bases all over the Pacific area, targeting China, wants to control the South China Sea, that are really Chinese waters. Can you imagine if Russia or China wanted to station even a couple of ships off America, warships off America's east or west coast, or establish a base in Canada, or in Central America, or in Mexico? Congress would consider that an act of war.
They would consider it an act of war and go to war right away against it. Yeah, and you hit the right thing, because that's the principled idea. What would happen if someone was trying to do that to us? That's where the principle begins. And yet nobody seems to be asking that question. And there's been a big chasm that has occurred in America over the last 30 years, in which the government operates strictly for its own interest and nobody else's interest except their own. And now you've got, we have an equivalent to LeMay. I don't know if he's going to be as bad as LeMay, but General Martin Dempsey, while you were talking about LeMay, I was thinking about some of the things Dempsey has said. He's always on Fox News shooting off his mouth about when there are hundreds of people killed in Syria or that massacre happened in Hula. He says, well, yeah, we've got the military option. And he's even expressed frustration with Obama by not going in yet. He's saying, we've got everything in place. We're ready to go. Let's go, you know, do some killing. He didn't put, that's not his exact words, but that's what his intent was to say, let's go. And it doesn't matter what happens in response, we can still overwhelm them. If that happened to us, every male American would be outraged and have their gun and be ready to go, but we don't care about that. It doesn't work in reverse. So, and that type of attitude has filtered all the way down, as I mentioned earlier, to the local level, so that now you've got a unilateral attack against the citizens in all kinds of different ways. I mean, it starts with Obama's attacks on free speech what was that latest order that he gave, that the Treasury Department is now authorized to freeze any assets of any U.S. citizen who in any way tries to obstruct the U.S.-backed administration in Yemen, whatever that means. So he's now targeting U.S. citizens who, in any way he decides, threatens Yemen's security by people opposed to that. And that trickled all the way down to people like, I wanted to ask you about, anyway, Rahm Emanuel in Chicago saying, we don't need firefighters. We can cut them back. We can cut their pay. We can cut their premiums. We can cut their health care benefits. Save a lot of money that way, and they're not going to say anything because everybody needs a job. I was going to ask you how that attack is working out for Chicago, or what Chicagoans are saying about that, or is it really just kind of quiet?
I think it's kind of passed under the radar by now, but we have a horror story from May. A guy who's been in office just a little bit over a year. He came into office in May of last year, so it may be around 13 months now. And I think in that short period of time, he is already the worst mayor in Chicago history. The worst mayor in Chicago history. We had 40 years of two Daleys, father and son, and that was no picnic. Chicago really ever has had anything even approaching a slightly good mayor, but Rahm Emanuel is absolutely the pits, and I'm ashamed to have to admit that I live in a city with this rogue, this absolute rogue, an unindicted war criminal is the mayor of my city. He should be arrested, he should be put on trial, he should be prosecuted, he should be convicted, he should be put in prison, and then he invited NATO into town, and NATO arrives everywhere violently, and the whole city was disrupted, not just for the few days that NATO was here. They disrupted my neighborhood. They disrupted my building. I wrote about it daily. And my goodness, I mean, the police came out and targeted non-peaceful protesters so these NATO killers could sit in their cocoon and plan the next wars they want to fight.
There you go.
This is what we have to live with, Bob.
Yep, that's part of the war that we've been talking about really from beginning to now. And I've wanted to put more emphasis on the local level because it's easy to be distracted by the international wars and intrigues going on. But I think what we need to recognize is that these wars are coming home to roost. And everything that Obama allows himself and Rahm Emanuel allows himself and that the people allow them to do by not being informed and by not caring about it, the more power they're going to take to do exactly what it is that they just want to do. And so that's what really has to be stopped. And that's where people have to start becoming aware that it's not just an international thing, it's a national thing and a local thing, and people have to start getting involved in putting a stop to it, or we're not going to be able to come back from it for many generations.
Oh, indeed so, Bob. We're just about at the top of the hour and out of time. I'll shoot you a very fast email because I have to scurry downtown. I will be on air 30 minutes from now, thereabouts, talking about Syria on a wonderful program, Press TV's Inside. Oh, my goodness. This happens to me all the time. News analysis. I'll be on their program. A marvelous program. There's nothing like that on US TV. And this marvelous program goes out to the world. Bob, I'll shoot you a fast email. I look forward to next time when you come on. And my great thanks, as always.
Thank you, Steve. Nice talking to you again.
And to my listeners, every Thursday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, make it a regular habit.